I'm not sure who our caller.
Lisa.
Lisa. Hi, Lisa. What's on your mind?
Well, I have only two words because there's no more time. Progressive taxation.
Yes.
Those four men that and more like them were there at the Trump's day. If they pay their not only the fair share, but enough so that the deficit, $36 trillion. Yeah. I think when Bill Clinton was in power, was the president, that he brought down the deficit and not increased it as much, but progressive taxation. Thank you.
Thank you, good words, Lisa.
Now those are two words that I don't mind ending a show on. Progressive taxation. I think something that we need to be reminded on.
Where does
the time fly?
It was fun.
We start getting into a really good conversation. We next time we need to make this a 2-hour show. Okay, Boo listeners, call in and tell them that you want PDX Progressive Talk Radio to be a 2-hour show on Wednesday.
We still need to work on increasing our time that we are on in a month. Right now we're once a month.
Yeah, so and that does remind me the third
tonight.
Tonight we're going to be back
it's
on.
It's a rerun from last
Hi,
month.
I'm David Brower, David R. Brower, and I add the R because there are 100 other David Browers in the United States, and that keeps me separate from most of them. I like the direction you're going in, KBOO, Portland, and I wish you had a lot more company.
It seems like recently the struggle to take action on climate change has gotten more complicated. And there are a lot of solutions that are presented to us that at first glance look kind of good because they have the words green or renewable in them. But then when you dig into them more deeply, it turns out that not only are they a waste of precious time, but they actually are climate solutions that are worse for the climate. It's like chasing chimeras, a beast from Greek mythology, which sounds fabulous, but ends up to be a fanciful illusion.
Chasing Chimeras, The Lure of Deceptive Climate Solutions, a new documentary by veteran producer Barbara Bernstein, premieres on Locus Focus Monday, January 27th at 10 a.m. Tune into Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM Portland, 104.3 FM Corvallis, or 91.9 FM Hood River, or anywhere in the world streaming online at kboo.fm. That's Chasing Chimeras, The Lure of Deceptive Climate Solutions on Locus Focus, Monday, January 27th at 10 a.m.
Hi, this is Kendall Boyson, professional life and recovery coach, and you're listening to Encouragementology, the practice of instilling hope. Hi there. Thanks for joining me. On this show, we are taking a deeper look at stress in an attempt to find our way back to peace. No matter what your level of stress is, everyone can benefit from a more peaceful existence. Because life can sometimes feel like an endless juggling act. And let's be real, most of us are using bowling pins instead of tennis balls. Between the pressure to perform, the nagging feeling of not being good enough, and the constant stress of adulting, it's no wonder so many of us are stuck in a cycle of burnout. But here's the good news. There's a way to hit the pause button, reclaim your peace, and rewrite the narrative playing in your head. In this episode, we're diving into how to manage stress, tackle the relentless inner critic, and embrace the idea that you're not just enough, you're extraordinary. We'll explore why so many of us feel like we're falling short, unpack the serious toll this mindset takes on our health, and share practical, empowering strategies to help you flip the script. Because let's face it, you deserve to feel good about yourself, and that starts today. Ready? With peace being the ultimate destination, let's chart a course offering valuable pit stops along the way. Maybe you sometimes feel stress, but aren't sure that it's bad or that you suffer from too much stress.
Maybe the word peace conjures up tie-dye and hip necklaces instead of a tranquil existence. Let's start with a few definitions to make sure we're all on the same page. Stress, a feeling of emotional strain and pressure that occurs when a person perceives an event as taxing or endangering their well-being. Peace, freedom from disturbance, tranquility. Okay, simple enough? Hardly. Stress has become a significant concern in modern society with profound impacts on health and well-being. Here are some striking statistics that highlight its seriousness. In the U.S., 77% of people report experiencing stress that affects their physical health, while 73% report stress impacting their mental health. Chronic stress is linked to numerous conditions like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and of course, depression. Stress is a major workplace issue, with 83% of employees reporting work-related stress and over half saying it negatively impacts their productivity. Stress-related absenteeism costs employers billions annually. Anxiety is on the rise, with 43% of adults reporting feeling more anxious in 2024 than the year before. Many cite current events, financial issues, and safety concerns as primary triggers. Among teenagers and college students, stress is pervasive. Over 80% of college students report feeling frequent stress, often linked to academic performance, finances, and future planning. Chronic stress can shorten life expectancy by 2.8 years on average due to its impact on immune function, aging, and increased risk of diseases. I keep thinking, with all the modern conveniences we have today, why are we more stressed than ever? When I like to reflect on the past to see how the struggles of today compare, I envision the Ingalls family. I think about Pa on the prairie, loading up the wagon in harsh weather for a long trip to Mankato for supplies. How he takes the shotgun and tells Caroline he should be back in a week. But oh, the uncertainty. It's not like she can track him with her GPS, or he can check in via text, or FaceTime her to ask which type of flower or fabric he should pick up. Now that's stressful. But we don't even have to go back to the 1860s to see the amplification of stress. At Healthline, I found why Americans are more stressed today than they were in the 1990s. We certainly live in stressful times, but how do they compare to how things were three decades ago? New research published examines the impact of stress on people who are middle-aged, finding a stark increase in day-to-day stress among people from 45 to 64 years old in the 2010s compared to the 1990s. In a new paper published in the Journal of American Psychologist, Penn State researchers looked at data from 1,499 adults collected in 1995 and then 782 different adults 17 years later in 2012. Both different groups had been interviewed on a daily basis for 8 straight days. They were asked about stressful experiences they had over the past 24 hours. The results? Researchers found that day-to-day stress and a sense of lower overall well-being were much higher in the 2010s compared to the 1990s. While people overall experienced about 2% more stress in the later decade, for middle-aged people, it was about 19% higher. Middle-aged participants in the survey showed a 17% increase in having a sense that stress would affect their future plans. They also had a 27% increase in the belief that their financial status would be affected by stress in the 2010s compared to the 1990s. Lead researcher Dr. David M. Almeida, professor of human development and family studies at Penn State College of Health and Human Development, told Healthline that at the onset, he and his colleagues expected life to be more stressful for people now compared to the 90s. What surprised them was this discrepancy between middle-aged people and other age groups. We thought that younger people in their late 20s and 30s would be the most stressed, with people coming out of an economic recession and low job prospects, entering economic uncertainty. But it was people about 50 to 64 who were the most stressed out. That stood out shockingly so. Almeida says that when they dug deeper in the data, it showed that people in their middle years seemed to have more demands and pressures placed on them, naturally elevating stress levels that might not be as existent for younger adults. For instance, people in midlife tend to be responsible for raising young adult children and getting them started in adulthood at the same time as taking care of older generations. It's a time of life when you're responsible not only for your own well-being, but the well-being of many people. Even at work, in midlife, you're entering management roles, and the sheer number of people you're involved with increases your opportunity to experience stress. Dr. Sudha Predikanti, integrative psychiatrist and Ayurvedic practitioner at the University of California, San Francisco, says this is reflected in what she sees anecdotally with her own patients. Predikanti, who wasn't affiliated with this new research, says she works with a lot of middle-aged women who take on a big brunt of these responsibilities and family duties. She says it's a pressing, defining issue that affects middle-aged women on a global scale, serving as something of a sandwich generation, stuck between taking care of aging parents and the labor of nurturing teens and young adults. Women in this age group also have to care for grandchildren as well, something exacerbated by the fact that post-Great Recession economic hardships forcing young adults to move back home, creating difficult-to-manage multi-generational households. This is certainly a new reality that existed more over the past decade than in the 1990s, a time of overall economic prosperity in the United States. It's important to note that in many ways, this is a very U.S.-centric stress driver, given that many non-Western cultures embrace older adults as sources of wisdom and respect. Predikanti told Healthline that our cultural de-emphasis on people as they gradually get older also places a psychological stress of its own, a very American problem that doesn't seem to be abating anytime soon. One of the things I'm practicing today is based on the idea that just because I can doesn't mean I should. I can do many, many things. In fact, I have never thought there was anything I couldn't do. Well, except sing on key. No matter how much I try, I know, joyful noise and all, blah, blah, blah. To avoid taking on too much and overloading myself and losing what little free time I have, I make a conscious effort to prioritize. I focus on what truly needs my attention, what genuinely brings me joy, and what I might be saying yes to simply because I struggle to say no. The other side of the coin is this feeling of not doing enough or not being good enough. I can't tell you the number of people I've spoken to who are stressed and unhappy with how far they've come and how far behind they see themselves. The feeling of not measuring up can significantly contribute to stress levels. Studies reveal that 65% of people struggle with self-esteem and the belief that they are not good enough, often impacting their mental health and increasing stress. These feelings are linked to workplace pressure, social comparisons, and internalized perfectionism, leading many to feel overwhelmed and undervalued. This sense of inadequacy can create a cycle of stress, reducing productivity and self-confidence while amplifying mental health challenges. For instance, nearly 40% of employees identify performance worries as a major stressor, underscoring how perception of self-worth impacts well-being. Kara M. Newman helps us understand what to do when you never feel good enough, found on Greater Good. Are you a good enough friend, employee, partner, or parent? Are you thin, attractive, smart, and nice enough? If you have doubts about yourself, you're not alone. In fact, clinical psychologist Ronald D. Siegel has heard this from many of his clients he's worked with for over nearly 40 years and grappled with them himself despite being an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. I noticed that there was one painful struggle almost everyone seemed to share, the relentless quest to feel better about themselves. He writes in his new book, The Extraordinary Gift of Being Ordinary. In fact, most of us go about our days with self-evaluative thoughts rattling through our brains, concerns about our performance at work, disappointment about what we see in the mirror, judgments of our lovability based on the last conversation we had. Even when we feel good about ourselves, that feeling is fragile, ready to be shattered by the next blow to our self-image. Instead of this self-referential chatter, Siegel suggests another way of being based on connecting with others rather than proving ourselves to them. His book offers tips for working with the feelings of not good enough and building a stable sense of happiness. Although constantly evaluating our worth is exhausting, it's also very human. The propensity to evaluate ourselves and compare ourselves to others, which was once useful for survival, is actually hardwired into the human brain. To win the evolutionary race and reproduce, early humans had to compete with others for status. Comparing ourselves to others, now an unfortunate side effect of social media, was once a survival skill. And being exiled from the tribe was a matter of life and death, so fears of rejection linger. Today, concerns about our adequacy can take different forms in each person. Maybe you want to feel special and get good grades or be attractive and make more money. Maybe you just want to be liked and have enough friends. Or maybe what's important to you is feeling educated, creative, and talented enough. In response to these feelings, we try to do everything we can to prove to ourselves and others that we are these things. Good, generous, strong, successful, sexy, but that doesn't work either. It's actually our relentless trying to feel good about ourselves that causes much of our distress. For example, research suggests that people who pursue external rewards like fame, power, wealth, and beauty in order to be popular are more anxious, depressed, and discontent compared to those who are focused on personal growth, relationships, and helping others. When our goals are external like that, we may find ourselves falling short all the time. There are always people doing better, so we can feel constantly judged. And if we ever hit a goal we had set for ourselves, we often just raise the bar again. Always performing, we rarely get a break to feel content or at peace. A preoccupation with being good enough can also get in the way of connecting with others. When we perceive any kind of criticism from friends or coworkers, we may feel threatened and get defensive. then our habit of self-judgment can spill over into harshly judging others, which, surprise, surprise, people don't really appreciate. And if we constantly feel insecure, we might try too hard to be liked or be too afraid to put ourselves out there in the first place. Over the years, all those times when we felt not good enough become a pool of accumulated sadness, hurt, and shame that can be triggered by things that happen in our daily lives. That weight is hard to carry. Just think of how wonderful a day would be without worrying so much about how well you're doing and what others think of you. Instead, simply enjoying life. Instead of trying to do more so we can finally feel worthy, the solution lies in shifting the focus altogether from self to others. That means building our relationships and practicing skills like compassion, gratitude, and forgiveness. In any given interaction, that means focusing on connecting rather than impressing. You can also tackle your feelings of shame directly. As researcher Brené Brown has pointed out, shame thrives in secrecy. And Siegel encourages readers to share their imperfections and foibles with others. More often than not, you'll find that you're not alone. And we all have aspects of ourselves that we are less than proud of. He also suggests having a bit of dialogue with your inner critic, asking them, "What are you afraid would happen if you weren't doing such a good job criticizing me?" Then you can turn to the wounded, insecure parts of yourself and ask, "What might you need right now?" The goal, according to Siegel, is to develop unconditional self-acceptance. An attitude similar to what you'd get from a good parent. I love you no matter what. That doesn't mean we don't hold ourselves to certain standards or feel disappointed when we fall short of them, but our missteps don't damage our value as human beings. We can work to develop this feeling of acceptance whether or not we behave intelligently, correctly, or competently, and whether or not others respect, love, or approve of our behavior, separating our evaluation of our abilities and behaviors from the sense of meaning or worth. That's easier said than done, of course. One way to move toward this kind of self-acceptance is to realize that your self-standards may not be ones you choose in the first place. You may have unconsciously drifted from your core values as you move through the world and were exposed to the opinions of others. For example, what do you think makes someone good and worthy? And where do you think those beliefs come from? What are the arbitrary rules that you expect yourself to follow? In a world of immediate gratification, just remember, the body is amazing and contains natural resources you can tap into for relief in the short and the long term. Self-regulation tools can be divided into quick fixes for immediate relief and long-term health practices for sustained well-being. Let's make sure we cover those. So a quick fix is excellent for acute stress or when you just need some fast relief. Long-term practices create a buffer against future stress and support sustained emotional balance. It's what we should all be looking for. Integration. Use quick fixes during high-stress moments while building long-term habits for resilience. So we're going to go through some of these because if you feel like everything that you use in your toolbox is just for a quick fix, then you're always going to be looking for the quick fix. You're not developing that lifelong term practice. So again, quick fixes, these are tools you can use in the moment to calm your stress or regain your focus. While effective for immediate needs, they don't address the underlying causes of dysregulation. So let's go through some of these. Number one, deep breathing, right? Take 4 to 5 deep breaths, inhaling for a count of 4, holding for 4, and then exhaling for a count of 4. This is a quick relaxation for the nervous system. It will also activate that vagus nerve, If you don't know about the vagus nerve, definitely check into that. Because if you feel your heart racing and you're starting to get anxious, taking those breaths will actually activate that vagus nerve, and it will send those impulses to your brain, into your body, to your heart, calming yourself down. Number two, 5-4-3-2-1 grounding technique. Now, this is different than Mel Robbins' 5-second rule, which would be 5 seconds to act on an impulse. This is different. So identify 5 things you see, 4 things you can touch, 3 things you can hear, 2 things you can smell, and 1 you can taste. This activity, almost like game-like, redirects focus and alleviates anxiety. It also, by the way, gives you enough time to kind of, you know, repace yourself before you act on impulse. Number 3, progressive muscle relaxation. Tense and release muscle groups from head to toe. This is a great way to isolate muscles. And so you may not even know they're tense until you cause yourself to look to tense up just that muscle. Then you might say, oh my goodness, my shoulders are already tight. Well, now I can release that. It relieves physical tension caused by stress. Number 4, short walk or movement break. A brisk 5 to 10 minute walk outside or light stretching. This can really boost your mood by releasing endorphins and clearing your mind. Plus, you're probably sitting at a computer. Take a break. Leave your phone at home. You don't always have to have noise in your ear. Go out and listen to nature. Number 5, journaling for 5 minutes. Okay, I've always said this doesn't mean diary. Okay, so don't feel bad if you're using journaling as a short-term fix and you're not doing it every day as a long-term practice. Okay, so this means writing down some of your thoughts or worries, just getting them on paper so that you can see them. This can provide mental clarity and emotional relief. Number 6. Mindful distraction. Engage in a quick, enjoyable activity like a puzzle or music. Get up and do a dance. Maybe make yourself something to drink or something that just sort of gives your mind a distraction. It offers temporary relief by shifting attention. I would say fold the clothes that are obviously sitting in the dryer, but that's just me. Okay. Moving on to long-term health practices. These build resilience and create a foundation for improved self-regulation over time. So, of course, we're going to start with mindful meditation. There are so many apps out there that you can use to help you here. I know my mind races all the time, and to sit there and commit to 10 to 20 minutes a day to cultivate present moment awareness sounds impossible. But don't you like a challenge? This will help you reduce stress and improve emotional regulation. If you are prayerful, hey, combine the two. Prayer is meditation. So make it your meditating prayerful moment. Number 2, exercise routine. Regular aerobic activity like walking, cycling, dancing, do something like that 3 to 5 times a week. This is going to strengthen your mind-body connection and release stress-reducing chemicals. Now, I know that I've never had a runner's high, and I hear people that go do CrossFit and they say, oh my gosh, I mentally can't handle life if I don't do CrossFit. I've never experienced that ever. But I will tell you that just a little aerobic exercise in the morning really gives you motivation for the rest of the day. Number 3, sleep hygiene. Prioritize 7 to 8 hours of quality sleep with a consistent bedtime routine. What does that look like? That doesn't mean looking at your phone like 2 seconds before you shut it off and go to bed. It means winding down. This world is so busy. Your brain needs a chance to decompress and unwind. This will regulate mood, energy, and cognitive function. You know, so many people say, oh, I only need about an hour or two of sleep. That's not humanly possible, okay? Your body is suffering somewhere. So maybe it's you can't sleep because you have too much going on. Start unpacking that so that you can get a few more hours of good sleep. Number four, healthy nutrition. Focus on a balanced diet with whole foods, reducing caffeine and sugar. Supports mental clarity and stable energy levels. Listen, we can all do a healthier diet. I say all, but I am learning so much about food and what's in it. And I just heard a podcast the other day that said, if you read the ingredients and you wouldn't put that on your counter and use it every day, don't eat it. So this is giving me a whole new idea of what healthy nutrition really looks like. Number five, therapeutic practices. Engage in regular therapy, counseling, or just self-reflection exercises. It may be important to share what's in your brain. So many of us kind of just keep it all upstairs and we don't express it. We don't talk about it. We don't bounce it off of other people. And left to our own cognition, sometimes those thoughts can get escalated, elevated, grandiose. So whether that's in a support group style setting or just with one other person, it's important. It helps you address root causes of stress and emotional dysregulation.